very much, Carol, for this nice and lively presentation of my exhibition. Sorry, my English is not that fluently, and I would like to apologize for reading from my notes because my English is not that good, and I hope you excuse this. I would like to thank you and Elisabeth Kogler from the Austrian Cultural Forum for the invitation to come here, and both of you supported my project from the beginning, so many thanks for that. It was a pleasure to work with you together. I'm very happy to present my exhibition, my project here, about Anna Freud's rustic furniture here at the place where the original pieces are located since decades. When maybe two words on my person. I'm an European ethnologist or cultural study person, so I'm not into psychoanalysis or psychology. I'm worked about history of psychoanalysis, working on a historical approach on that topic. So that's maybe to let you know my background and how my perspective is on furniture. And I come from material culture studies, so this is also a very important view I brought in. So when I visited the Freud Museum 3 years ago for the first time, I was very surprised to encounter furniture from the Alpine regions from Austria and Bavaria. In the dining room, I have been assistant curator at the Freud Museum in Vienna for some years, and at that time no one had told me about that furniture so far, so I was very surprised seeing it here. The 5 pieces down in the dining room, you may know them, for me have a very strong presence, and they determine the room. So, and I hope I can manage to move the PowerPoint, defreeze, and now... This one. Or is that, if not, I'm going to make it on the computer. So I'm going to make this.
No, I don't want to look too bad.
I think I've now messed it up by putting.
Before you have seen the 5 pieces which are down in the dining room, and here you have 2 photos from the archives, here taken in 1982 after Anna Freud's death. They show the cupboards and chests as they were arranged by Anna Freud, plus the other mementos from Austria. The pendulum clock made by a Viennese watchmaker, Jewish watchmaker, and a picture souvenir from Bad Gastein, a former summer residence of the Freud family in Austria. Everything is still there. So here is this picture souvenir, and over there is the pendulum clock. So I got interested in the room, and especially in the furniture, probably also because I'm doing research about the importance of folk art in the 1920s and 1930s. I try to understand why the things from Austria are there in the dining room and if they are telling a specific story. Back in Vienna, I began to study Anna Freud's correspondence and did research in different archives in Austria and also here in the Freud Museum. And as I said, I had a long and close look at the things, at the furniture, with my material culture view. The pieces of furniture once were an integral part of a weekend house near Vienna. Anna Freud and Dorothy Burlingham bought the farmhouse in autumn 1931.
Sorry, I don't know how to get off. It's my fault, I think, that... sorry, can I just do it, just to try and...
They called the place Hochroth Erd, which was also the name of the village. These two photos show the current situation. A couple bought the house in the 90s, and they are running a riding stable there. I think a very sympathetic riding stable. We both had possibility to meet it. Hochrot Erd meant a lot to Anna Freud and Dorothy Burlingham, as we learn from various letters and documents. The two women spent many days and weekends there. They more and more used it as a so-called big middle house. They liked to do gardening or riding and organized picnics for friends and colleagues. They were also owner of a little farming with cows and chicken and liked to take care of the animals. Naturally, they had also someone who managed the property, by the way, very much to the satisfaction of the owners. Some tea. So here you can see a plan from 1933 for Anna Freud. It says, a plan zur Erbauung eines Hühnerstalls für Miss Fräulein Anna Freud. So she built a 60-meter-long chicken house. 60 meters are about 52 feet, I tried to find out. And end of December 1933, she wrote to Louis-André Salomé, and I'm quoting now my own translation. Papa is not leaving the house and suffers from his catarrh, but for the rest, everything is in order. Winter here in Vienna is cold and wet and dark and makes us feel bad, but my farmhouse gets more and more beautiful. Now, during the holidays, I am going there very often. I would like to stay there even more. In the new co-op, the chicken laid 25 eggs a day. Now we want to grow mushrooms. So with this farmhouse, Anna Freud and Dorothy Burlingham were part of the so-called weekend movement, which appeared in big cities like Berlin, but also Vienna. City dwellers had small private houses on the edge of the city where they lived a different life. They were looking for a new living experience, staying in simple houses with simple rural furniture, wearing traditional costumes. And you may know the photos showing Anna Freud wearing Dindl's costumes. So did Anna Freud and also Dorothy Burlingham. For the two women, Hochrot Erd was also or mainly a private place. There they could live an undisturbed life, far away from the Berkas and from the Freud family, probably also from the father. In March 1938, when the Nazis took power in Austria, Anna Freud and Dorothy Burlingham were forced to sell Hochrot Erd. It was Dorothy Burlingham, she was a psychoanalyst also, who were thinking about their new future circumstances and arranged the packing of the furniture in Hochrot Erd. She was moved by the thought that in the future the pieces might be a precious memory for both of them. As an American, she was at first not bound by the regulations around the restrictive export ban imposed by the National Socialists. The idea of taking something of personal value into immigration corresponds to the concept of the British anthropologist David Perkin. He says that in cases of human displacement, people carry not only what they need for subsistence and exchange purposes, but also, if they can, articles of sentimental value. In times of change and in unfamiliar surroundings and situations, those objects might convey a sense of familiarity and through that security. Maybe some of you know that Dorothy Burlingham in April 1938 left Vienna to Lugano, Switzerland and then to the US, to the United States. She came to England in 1940. Anna Freud left Vienna with her parents on 4th June 1938. The day before she had to sign the sale of the property in Hochrot Erd as a consequence of Nazi repression. The furniture then was first sent to the United States and 6 years later, in 1946, to Great Britain. That year, Anna Freud wrote to August Eichhorn, a former colleague from the Vienna Psychoanalytic Society, quote, "And Mrs. Burlingham and I have bought ourselves a small house on the sea on the east coast of England, a sort of replacement for the lost cockroach air, which we are finding it very hard to get over. So for me, the photos from 1982 make clear that Anna Freud someday moved the furniture from the coast to London, back into her home and workplace. Maybe this happened in the 1970s, when she returned to Austria together with Dorothy Birmingham for visits. The meaning of things changes just as memories or life worlds or ways of life change. In the dining room in London, Anna Freud now faced the furniture every day. In this ordinary and not entirely private room, these pieces of furniture influenced her thoughts and actions. They took a new significance and presence for their owner. This alpine furniture probably was also a starting point for conversations about Austria, about the past, the life in Hochrodert, about loss, we don't know. The exhibit First Dining Room Furniture Moves Memory follows the history of the furniture and attempts to trace the relevance of the cupboards and chests for Anna Freud before 1938 and afterwards. And this leads me now to the form of the presentation of the show in Vienna. The exhibit is distributed among five stations, so I used the five cupboards and chests from the dining room. And because of their biography, I didn't want to bring them back to Austria. They refused to be returned to Austria in their original form. Therefore, the exhibit developed a special display to stimulate perception and insight into time and place. And I'm glad that Alex Kubik, the designer of the show, is also present. He came late, but he's here. And also my graphic designer, Lisa, who did the catalog, is here. So I'm glad. Had a good team. So here you can see the first station of the exhibit. It shows parts of the olive-colored cupboard from Bavaria in an abstract way and deals with the owners of this cupboard. The name of the former owner is written at the top of the chest. You can see it a little bit. It's called Elisabeth Lachstettnerin, and it's also a year there. And from the painting, we learn that she was a woman with Catholic background. This is the saint is painted on the right-hand side. The last owner was Anna Freud, who bought the furniture along with others around 1930, probably from antique dealer. So this was a very time where a lot of people from intellectuals, artists, city, urban people bought this kind of furniture to put them in their private houses at the end of the city. I called this new Viennese objects substitutes of the originals. Maybe you have already seen the little we have a little wooden object prop with us. Can put it in an envelope afterwards, and you can might have an idea how we resolved bringing the painting on the material. The substitutes can be described as digital photography on softwood. To create a sensory experience of Anna Freud's furniture, for me, wood was the most suitable material. Wood is a historic material, it preserves history and connects generations. The second very important part of the Vienna display is photography. Alice took pictures of all pieces of furniture in the dining room using a very level gaze. Photographs contain ethnographic data. They are memories or souvenirs which we collect when we travel. Plus, a photo is not just a picture of an object. Photos produce the image. At the moment at which I look at the photo, there is an active element. I negotiate with it, and I deal with it. The exhibit does not show a photo of furniture in its entirety. Digital photography offers the very convenient operation of selection and filtering. I can focus on one thing by excluding others. So this reduction helps us in concentrating the gaze on the furniture's defining characteristics. So that's why we chose here the name of the owner and her saint, and this tells something about the first owner of this cupboard. So the selected details that tell something about the furniture itself. Together with the wood, they form the new artifacts or substitutes. They transmit the furniture and its story to Vienna, but at the same time, the incomplete character made clear that the furniture is not here. And it should also make clear the constructed and fragmentary nature of the narration. The white frame, by the way, is of the same wood and has the dimensions of the original object. Visitors can touch the cupboard door, can open it, and read the text behind. There's, and here at this station, there's also an interview with an intern of the Freud Museum. She talks about the daily use of the cupboard by the museum shop. They are storing souvenirs, Freud souvenirs, inside. And by the way, all the stations are in front of objects of our own collection. You see here another cupboard of our cupboard collection, which has also the name of a woman painted, and tells another story, the story of a woman coming from a Protestant context. This station, I will just show you station number 4, which was called Packing Up. You see here a little bit the arrangement of our idea was packers come in Hochho there to put away the doors to pack it and to send it. It tells the story that it was Dorothy Burlingham who organized the collection of the furniture in Hochroder, thinking they would be important for Anna and her future. In addition to these 5 stations, the exhibit works with another element of the dining room. When the Freuds left Vienna, they took with them the pendulum clock. You can experience it at the dining room. It strikes every 15 minutes. In the Vienna Museum, visitors hear a sound collage. There's the noise and voices taken from the Freud Museum here, noise from the street, also from the subway station, and between again and again the sound of the pendulum clock. I understood or understand the sound collage and the furniture as abstraction that one removes as mediation objects, as memory vehicles. They connect the past with the present, contemporary Vienna with contemporary London, a bygone London with a bygone Vienna. And of course, pieces of furniture to come to an end come from an interrupted past. In the moment of the experience of national socialist exclusion and expulsion, they became things of emigration. In the new period of life, their meaning were primarily symbolic. They became mirrors of concrete memories of life, once loved but destroyed and lost through historical events. The museum in Vienna wants to remember this individual story and bring it to present by using an updated form of presentation. Anna Freud's furniture reveal the complexity and constellation of historical, social, cultural, and biographic components. Although Anna Freud and the past are absent, an exhibit with its elements of mediation and memory can still transmit the materiality of what is lost. More than giving answers, the exhibition about Anna Freud wants to stimulate reflection about remembrance and individual feelings. And this is the last page from the photo album Anna Freud gave to her father in December 1931. It's the original is here in the Freud Museum. And we have the photo album in the exhibit. People can look it through. It was gift to New Year's, 1932, and it was an invitation to Sigmund Freud, for Sigmund Freud, to visit the two owners in Hochrodert. And with this, auf nach Hochrodert, I would like to thank you for your attention and patience. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and I think you get a flavour of the sort of interesting way in which the furniture has been used and taken to Vienna, even if in a virtual form rather than a real form, and I suspect we might come back to talking about that. But I wonder if I could now hand over to Anne-Marie, who is going to talk in a more sort of personal way, I think, about some of the stories of this house and the time when Anna Freud and Dorothy Burlingham were living here.
I am afraid that I may disappoint you, because of course the number of episodes I have to tell about Anna Freud or the Rossi Burlingham and the furniture is relatively limited. But I can say one thing which will maybe amuse you. The first time I came here into this house was when I had been accepted as a student, but I had had my interviews with colleagues of Anna Freud, but I had never met her. And so as I had arrived, she asked me to come. And of course, I thought that she would ask me lots of complicated questions over psychoanalysis. For 1 week or two, I did nothing but read and read and learn and try to find out the difference between Anna Freud and Melanie Klein and whatever. And I came, my head was full of data. And then she came and she said, "Oh, I see on your form that you come from Switzerland." So I didn't quite expect that as a first question of an interview. And I said, "Yes, I come from Geneva." "Oh, but tell me about the mountains." And I discovered that she loved mountains, she loved walking in the mountains. And she showed me the furniture, which was, I was very surprised, but she showed me in the dining room what she had. And she asked me whether in Switzerland we have the same. So that was my first introduction, both with Anna Freud, but also with the furniture. Afterwards, you will be amused to know that she didn't ask me anything about psychoanalysis. But when I came to her, it was a very cold autumn day, and she bent forward and nearly whispered, but we were only the two, so there was no reason to whisper. She said, "Do you have warm underwear?" So another thing which surprised me, I didn't expect that this would be my interview. But I felt very much at home. And then the end, which was also amusing, is that she asked me where I lived, and I said, "I have a room in a..." And then she said, "Are the windows closing? Because in this country, they don't know how to build houses. They are not like with us on the continent, where you know how to keep warm." And on this basis, we agreed that we had something in common, and I left. So that was my beginning with Anna Freud. But I did feel very honored that she showed me this wonderful furniture. And it interested me because in some part of the mountains in Switzerland, we have something which is a bit similar. So it
more
made...
Beautiful.
What you said?
More beautiful.
Maybe, but thank you. But it made me feel that we had something in common, which was very nice because I was quite homesick. So that was my first... Now, the other thing that I can say about Anna Freud is, first of all, what is important is, after a very short time where Melanie Klein, poor Dorothy Burlingham, she would turn in her baby cub. Dorothy Burlingham lived independently, but in 1941, she had already moved to be with Anna Freud. Partly, it made a lot of sense because there was war, there was difficulty in keeping warm and keeping safe. To be alone in this house after the death of her father was difficult, and the two women found that they could collaborate, and they both, of course, were very eager to help in the in with children, with, you know, the war children. Because what I was preparing a little bit is memories of things which were very typical of Anna Freud. Now, one thing which was quite interesting, which is the story that my husband told me, who did the training before me, so it was before my time. But at that time, Anna Freud was still teaching the people of the Institute of Psychoanalysis, but because of her age, the students had to come here. And as you know, Anna Freud had a helper called Paula, who was a wonderful cook. And so when the student came in the evening for their lecture, there was the most delicious tea and coffee, but the tea, especially in winter when it was cold, there was some alcohol added to it. And the student, of course, adored it. Plus cakes and biscuits and all sorts of wonderful things to eat. And then Anna Freud went to the States for Easter. And when they came back to another course by Anna Freud here, they were a bit consternated, because when they looked at the table, there was no tea, there was no coffee, and there was a funny kind of bottle, large bottle, which was standing there. And Anna Freud announced, "You know, this time I didn't prepare tea or coffee because I brought you something very special from America. It's a drink which is called Coca-Cola." So I remember the rather disappointing moment. Another memory I have, of course, that we had for a long time when after the war, she started the Anna Freud Center, what we call the Anna Freud Center, but which used to be called the Hampstead Clinic. And we had meetings regularly on Wednesday afternoon from 2 to 4, and also occasional evenings with the people from the institute on Wednesday evening. But for 5 years from the first attempt to start the Anna Freud Center, what is now the Hampstead Clinic, and the real, the acquiring a building, there were a 5 year period. So between 5 years, the students had to go for the lecture to the home of the teachers, and they had to see their children in the different hospitals or sometimes private consulting rooms of the teachers to be able to work. And I remember that, and then on the Wednesdays, it was again a great treat because we came here. And we sat downstairs. On the left was the Freud thing on Freud's room. We could see it. And then Anna Freud sat in an armchair, which we tried to find out if it was the armchair that she used when her father was alive, and we discovered, yes, it was. And and Mrs. Burlingham sat in another chair. Then we were all around listening to her. And this was very special. And of course, again, we were spoiled by something to drink and eat. So that was an aspect of Anna Freud which we all remember, her very great generosity. Now, one thing happened to me which was also something that I experienced in this house, was that I had heard, and there were rumors, and it was also written in books, that Anna Freud was not terribly close to her mother, but she was extremely close, as you know, to her father. And when her father died, the mother continued to live here. And on one occasion, Anna Freud had asked me to come to visit her for something, to discuss. And I rang the bell, and usually it was always Paula who came to open the door. And I heard already her step, which was not Paula's, and it turned out to be Mrs. Freud. And in my confusion and horror, in a way, I come from Switzerland, I knixed. Knixed, you say curtsies. I curtsied to her. I didn't know what I was doing. And instead of laughing or something, she was delighted. And she started talking German. I unfortunately speak German, but she started to say, "You are well behaved." I blushed and I didn't see I did not know what I said. And then I heard Anna Freud opening her door, and then Mrs. Freud quickly showed me where to go. So that's a memory of the house. Now, another memory which was interesting is indeed that Anna Freud had a room right on top of the house. But next to her, if I'm not mistaken, was the house of Mrs. Burlingham, the flat of Mrs. Burlingham. And so I remember going, according to what reason I was coming, sometimes to Mrs. Burlingham and sometimes to Anna Freud. And I must say, as in the way they related to people was so different, it was really quite striking, because Anna Freud was very warm in the first interview, as I was able to say, very personal, very, very, very charming. But the next time I saw her, I was completely lost, because she didn't even say hello, nothing. She was the lady who organizes this meeting, and we had to sit, and it was clear that the students had to be at the back, and she had no time for us. And I realized later that it was not at all that she didn't remember, that she was indifferent, but she was painfully shy. So you couldn't, it took years until we became very friends, but very, very friendly and friends. But her first contact was one of enormous shyness and withdrawal. Whilst Dorothy Burling was a real, for me, what I would say of an American, warm and friendly, and how are you, and what did you do, and oh, you didn't go out last night, oh, what a shame, I hope you go out on Saturday. I mean, completely different. And I often wondered how these two ladies could be so different. But I think, of course, that they compensated for each other beautifully. And I also discovered that the Dorothy Burling was extremely sensitive, and this very great warmth that she had was not really just, you know, let's be nice with this poor little newcomer who is nervous and doesn't know quite what to say, but that was much more profound, and she made always very, very deep and meaningful remarks and friendships. So I think she was an enormous support for Anna Freud when she lost her father. It was, and also the muse and the war, she was not left alone, which I think was of enormous importance. I just look if I have something more to say, because Anna Freud was very, in her shyness, she also had a chance to observe us quite attentively. And so there was a the people she picked up for certain tasks and who then became more part of the organization of the clinic. And the others, which she was very decent and friendly and interested about, but who were not quite her type or not quite what she hoped for, and they just did their course and left. Now, I was lucky, and she, I don't know if she liked the fact that I loved the countryside and animals and walking in the mountain, but we often spoke about this. This was very important for her. And she also told me on one occasion, maybe that tells you the kind of openness that she could have. My husband had finished training as psychoanalyst well before me, and was very keen to do research. And of course, the Anna Freud was a perfect place to do that. And she indeed invited him, and she offered him a wonderful opportunity to research. But I think what happened is that my husband was, I would say now, quite creative, but at the time I would say audacious. And he didn't feel that he needed to pass his entire time just repeating and speaking about Freud in the same way that was. He wanted to try to get something new, something inventive, something. And so Anna Freud found it sometimes exciting, and on the whole, she was wonderful, absolutely wonderful in those two discussions, which were wonderful to listen to. But at other times, she found it difficult. And on one occasion, I was scheduled to come for something quite different when my husband had been with her for about an hour or another. And when I came in, she looked at me and said, "He can be very difficult, your husband. You know that." I was rather embarrassed, and I didn't quite know what to say. So, and then she looked at my kind of, I think, embarrassment, and said, "Don't be embarrassed. You know, he knows his Freud, and so I forgive him everything. As long as you know him, your Freud, you will be forgiven." That was very, I thought, very warm and very nice. What Anna Freud took with her from Vienna is her love for plants, and her garden is quite beautiful. And once the flowers which were planted there and the arrangement of the garden are hers, that's how she wanted it. And it's very touching, actually, that the people who work here have made it their duty not to change. And it's the same roses in the same place. But I think the result is very positive. I think if you have questions and if you are curious in certain ways, it would be a pleasure to tell you. But otherwise, I really don't feel that I have anything very much to tell about the Anna Freud and the house. I think she was very happy here. Or maybe what I could say also is that because of the war, I'm thinking of her great friend, which was a great friend, with Mariana Kreis and Dr. Kreis, who two very important analysts, and who had two children. Plus, of course, Mrs. Burlingham, as you probably know, had four children. And also, Mrs. Burlingham had,
four.
Yes, it's fine. And of course, she had therefore quite a lot of traffic, because people came, stayed a week or some stayed a month until they had found a place to live. She had lots of people who had not had the help that she had. and who manage nevertheless to leave, but often with nothing.
What happened to Mr. Berliner?
I don't quite know. I think they divorced, and I think he died early, if my memory is correct. Do you know?
That's correct.
Is that correct? Thank you.
What was your age difference with Anna?
Excuse me?
What was your age difference with Anna Freud?
My age when I...
I'm not asking your age, but how much difference in age? Yeah.
Oh, enormous. I was 25, and she was then already over 60. So it wasn't, I mean, it was really teacher and pupil, so auntie and but she liked very much everything which had to do with nature, with beauty, I must say, and with something alive. I mean, she bought this a house here in Mulder Street, which was absolutely wonderful, and it's also a very nice place. I think she was influenced. I am not quite sure who bought it first, because she bought a house, but I think it was after her son, who was an architect, had bought something. So the family, there were three houses, I think.
Her brother.
Sorry, yes. It's her brother.
Yeah. You were about to reveal, Simon.
No, it's her brother, sorry. But three families, because another member of the family, as Freud, also bought a house there. So that it was a little... holiday place where she went. I mean, I can just tell you that, but it has nothing to do directly with the house. But every Friday at 12:15 precisely, the car with Anna Freud at the wheel would come out, and she was driving 2.5 hours to Wolbersby. Now, we had as a task, the people who worked at the Anna Freud, to make notes on our work with children. And a little half page, a kind of resume of what had happened that week, was to be given to her. So we had Peter, age 8, he did this and this and this this week, and we are a bit disappointed because he's still very... resentful, let's say, and Jenny, and another little. And these were supposed to be put into a box before 12 o'clock on Friday. Now, many of us did it between 11:45 and 12:10, and then you could see in the Marischfield Gardens around 12:10, a flock of young ladies running up to give it still to Anna Freud, who was already in her car, but they opened the windows and very friendly she took it.
Thank you. That was amazing. Thank you. It's very special, you know, when you work here and you sort of take the house for granted and things, but to hear some of these very kind of real and personal stories and just be reminded that this was someone's home, this was their working life as well, but that sort of professional life as well as the working life that happens.
Maybe there's one little detail which I've never quite understood why, but it showed me a certain maybe curiosity, because if I'm not mistaken, most of the rooms give up to the garden. And Anna Freud told me once that she very much likes to work on the landing between here and downstairs. There is a little table, and there she would install herself. And she did say to me, it's a very nice place, I can see what's going on in Marie's regard. Now, at that time, it is true that the Anna Freud clinic or the clinic had several buildings in the street. So when she looked out, she probably saw quite a few of us walking. But she was there watching, looking, and then working. But she felt probably part of it, which I thought was quite amusing.
It also gets lovely afternoon sun. Yeah, it's half perfect. Landing, so that may have also
been.
Shall we, hand over to Bettina now? And then, please sit, and we might then come back to some more questions and discussion.
Good.
Bettina, that's hard to follow some of these personal stories and anecdotes, but to talk a bit about the work that you've been doing here in the archive and your exhibitions. So.
Yes. Okay. It's really, I don't have any notes, but there's so much I could talk about, and I try to think of what would be most interesting for you, and I don't know you, so I'm going to start maybe with a brief introduction. I'm an artist. I work mostly with photography and installation work, and it's all around the human beings, all around portraiture, really. And I'm originally from Germany, from Munich, actually, and I've lived here in London over 20 years. Now, maybe one thing to say to connect with why we're here, the furniture, Anna Freud's furniture, for me, I think I never really got my head, I never really understood what it meant to me, like so many other things I never understood, but I think it sort of reminded me a little bit of home. When I first came to the Freud Museum, I was drawn to it for lots of reasons, but one of the reasons it always reminded me a little bit of home, and because my parents live in the same flat in Munich where my grandmother lived, and so it goes back generations, and therefore all the old furniture is still there, and my parents have never given anything away, and nothing has changed, and we do in fact have some of very similar furniture in the flat where I grew up. So I think more and more I'm beginning to think maybe this is one of the reasons why I'm so drawn to this place, because it maybe reminds me a little bit of home, and you know that sort of that feeling of, you know, I live in Shoreditch now, which is pretty much the opposite of being here, and you know, a tinsy little flat, and with a sort of looking out onto a wall and some bins. So coming here is like, it's really special and always has been. But I've been drawn to the house for as long as I can think. And I guess starting with the exhibition I saw here by Sophie Cull when I was an undergraduate student in London. And I always thought, God, I wish I could have an exhibition here, but I thought I could never have an exhibition here because I work with photography and it's so two-dimensional, and where would it make sense? But I couldn't stop thinking about it. So years went past, and I saw exhibitions and more and more. And then eventually my work changed, and from being sort of very straightforward conceptual, well, never kind of straightforward, but from being a conceptual portrait photographer, I started to become slightly more adventurous and, you know, exploring more sort of installation-based work, and perhaps that gave me more confidence to approach the museum. And then the opportunity came up here to do a residency in response to the legacy of Anna Freud rather than Sigmund Freud. And that sort of changed things a lot, because I just suddenly felt like this is what could really be my focus and my research. And so I spent 5 months here, to cut a long story short, slightly shorter. I spent 5 months here as artist in residence, and that was 2013-14. And I was exploring the Anna Freud archive and her collection, really. There was no sort of studio space for me, so I was in the middle of the upstairs offices on a sort of desk which was kindly set up for me. And I felt incredibly privileged to be there. At the same time, I felt like a spare tool, because I was like, oh my god, I'm like in the way. I was slightly in between places, and Carol was off for a year. So why am I telling you all this? I'm trying to explain. It was incredibly moving to be here, and I was moved, and at the same time, I was so moved that I felt quite distracted by that. I couldn't actually think of what kind of work would I ever add to this place. So I read lots of Anna Freud's correspondence and the letters that she received from Dorothy Burlingham during their separation during the Second World War. So I read the letters that she received from Dorothy Burlingham, also just before her father died, and then after, and I felt like part of me thought I shouldn't really read this. This is so personal. But then again, it was the archive. So, and then I think the work that I produced is ultimately is very personal, and it's a response to the things I've seen, the things I've read. But it's also a response to the walls. So I couldn't really pin it down anymore. And in this whole journey, I went to Wolverswick because I really wanted to see what the house where Dorothy and Burlingham and Anna spend their weekends. And I heard so much about it, and I read so much about it. So I wanted to go to Wolverswick. And in fact, with my husband and my daughter, we went there, and I found the house. I asked people in the neighborhood, because it wasn't very clear where the house was. And then we found the house, and then I knocked on the door, and a woman opened and said, I'm here on holidays. What do you want? And I said, this is Anna Freud's house. Do you know that? And she said, no, I don't know this, but I'm renting this house from an agency in the next door village. So I went to the agency, and then they didn't know it was Anna Freud's house either. But they said, yeah, you can rent it out. So I rented it out. So the next half term, we went there on a two families and on a sort of break. And I just wanted to sort of get more of this kind of, the spirit of that place and the garden. And so that was really interesting. But again, there was no way I could make work in that garden. And I tried and I failed and I tried and I experimented. And then, anyway, it's such a lot of things more and more I found my distance, I should say, and it was only a long time after the residency that I actually started to feel like I was ready to make some work in response to this house, because it is very loaded. I mean, you can't not feel almost overwhelmed when you come here and spend time. And in fact, I still feel overwhelmed by it. But I have found a good place to sort of. I think the most important work, if you see anything before you leave, is the work in the stairwell, and it's sort of where Anna Freud used to sit and look out the window, and maybe she was sat there also with Dorothy Burlingham, and had a cup of tea sometimes. Who knows? But. On both sides of the stairwell, I've placed my work, and that is the most important work I've made for the exhibition, I guess. And it's called The Sessions. It's 50 fragments of the same image. So it's basically, I've taken a portrait of a girl, a 6-year-old girl, and I made a silhouette portrait. From that image, I then created 50 variations. 50 being a sort of very significant number for me, because it's 50 minutes to an analytic session. And I've been also in analysis for a long, long time. Not anymore, but I used to be. And that also plays into the work that I've produced here and the experience I've had. And I guess the search I'm on. So those 50 fragments are representative of an analytic hour, and they're also kind of representative of my experience of analysis and the kind of fragmentation of your memories or your present and your life and your stories and your I mean, everything you experience really is fragmented. So it's like a portrait of a child, but then again, it's not a portrait at all. And the child is quite important because it's the daughter of a very close friend, and I've worked with that family over many years. So more and more I begin to understand that I like working long term with my sitter. I don't go enjoy photographing somebody once. If I would photograph somebody once, it's very likely I would like to photograph them twice and again and again and perhaps over years. So if, with that particular family that this girl belongs to, I've been working since this girl was born, which is now 12 years ago. So, and I photographed the mother, and the mother also is appears in this exhibition downstairs. If you have a chance, in the dining room, there's three light boxes of women in silhouette, and one of them is the mother of that child. And I think the silhouette is sort of appropriate for the Freud Museum because it preserves an anonymity of the sitter. And there's this kind of idea of confidentiality and, you know, something is revealed and and something is concealed, and the more we see, the less we know, in a way. So I'm thinking there's something very private about a silhouette, and it's actually very telling, even though we don't see very much of the actual sitter. So it's about a protective darkness, if you like, and yeah, which kind of, I'm going to wrap it up soon. But which sort of leads me to the dark room, where all the work has been produced. You know, those silhouettes, they're all made in the dark room and with trays, very old fashioned for many people nowadays who work digitally. But, for me, working in the dark room with a red safe light was very important. And it feels very intimate to work in a dark room. You have a red light and you have these chemical baths and you're shut away from the world and you just deal with your image, which sort of slowly appears up from your tray. And printing the same negative over and over over almost a year was quite interesting. And I wanted to bring an element of that experience into the museum. So I've made the study into a dark room. So when you go in the study, during the opening, not today, but during the opening, we made the whole study dark, and only the red lights that I installed were visible. So, the study and the Sigmund Freud study and library became a dark room for an evening, and you can still see a trace of that. So, it's this idea of, you know, it's a very creative place. Ultimately, psychoanalysis for me is something the most creative encounter between two people that I can think of almost, and I wanted to make something that is sort of reminiscent of my creative process, but also in this house. Maybe that's a good place to stop.
Thank you as well. So each of you has been kind of extraordinary in your own takes on sort of bringing something different out of this house and Anna. But can I open this up? I mean, if anyone has any comments or question?
Sorry, I've just got a question about describing the reading of the letters. What is the quality of the correspondence which those letters? I mean, was it a sort of romantic friendship, or what was it?
Oh, I see. Well, I suppose I wouldn't interpret it as romantic. I would interpret it as a very heartfelt, a very you know, a very deep friendship, but like a passionately deep friendship. And you know, how deep I wouldn't dare to say, but I think it's also not completely different to the correspondence that is published between Eva Rosenfeld and Anna Freud, and equally there, I mean, it's the language of those days. It's slightly different to what we use today, I guess, and friendships expressed in letters, it was a different era, it was a different, I can relate to it, because I've written friend when we were sort of in different countries, and perhaps very similar, but not as eloquent. But I think you when you're young, and also when you're older, you can feel very, very, very passionate about your sort of female friendships, and that's what I connected with in those letters. But I mean, there was love. What kind of love? I would know. Mm. But yeah.
The letters in German or English? Did Dorothy Berlin speak German?
Well, the letters are in English.
And Anne-Marie, do you know whether Dorothy spoke German?
I don't think so. But I'm not sure, but I don't think so.
And did they meet professionally? How did they meet?
Dorothy Bellingham came to Vienna to have her children analyzed.
Ah,
and she went to be helped by Freud.
Oh, okay.
And that's how they met.
So there's a whole family sort of romance. Yeah. Like, I'm using that word lightly. Not lightly.
So she Mrs. Bellingham brought her children to Freud, to the father.
Yes.
And then she met Anna in the process.
And then Anna also helped with the children. Mm. And, I mean, they were for a time also in a special school which Anna had a lot of say about this at time. So it was very intertwined.
And were they just disturbed children?
I think
I wouldn't say that the special school was certainly not for disturbed children at all. The Hitzingschule is what I'm talking about. It was a reaction to the very rigid,
didactic sort of Rudolf Steiner
teaching.
Yes, it was absolutely.
And they wanted more curiosity-led teaching.
Yes, so it was a
liberal and early on the start of
the
school.
The terrible regimentation.
Yes, but what was interesting in the sense, and that's what I was trying to convey, that contrary to now, there was a bit of a mix-up between the relationship between the analyst and the friendship with other members of the family, which nowadays we would avoid. But that was not the case at that time.
I would say as well, quite a lot of visitors who come here are very curious about the relationship between Anna and Dorothy, and different things have been said and written about their relationship. I think you would agree. As I understand it, there really is no conclusive proof one way or another as to whether exactly the nature of their relationship.
Emily Dickinson had a very passionate connection with her sister-in-law, and that's kind of completely riveting. But there's no evidence of anything, actually, you know, but it doesn't really matter in the
way. Exactly, I was going to say, in a way, it's not really, you know, they obviously had a very, very intimate friendship and relationship, and as you say, Anna was helped with the children, and so it sort of became a very entangled relationship. Would you...
Yes, I think there are many things that one can say elements the truth there together. Both Anna Freud and Dorothy were daughters, the youngest daughters of extremely powerful men, that everybody looked up to and didn't notice anybody else. So they shared that in common. And Dorothy then married as well a very powerful man, who was also quite damaged, but also a very powerful man. So I think they had very similar experiences. That made them feel kinship,
yeah,
that they understood each other.
read about that, do you think? Is that book?
Well, there's going to be an exhibition here soon about that.
Oh, okay.
But I think the Elizabeth Young Grove, yes, her biography of Anna Freud is definitive, and I think it's excellent.
I mean, it's quite a sort of substantial biography. There is a biography of Dorothy Burling, isn't
yes.
there? But I've read it. I don't know. Would you recommend
yes.
that?
Yes.
Yes.
I do.
Yeah. The Last Tiffany. Her father was Louis Comfort Tiffany. Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Well, he was the jeweler.
The glass. Yes. So she came from an extraordinarily family background. Yeah. And also, I think, just from the life, back to your point, I mean, the house here that they shared in the Vienna woods kindly took me there, largely, but it was a very romantic setting. I don't mean, again, I don't mean to imply anything in their relationship, but it must have been very idyllic when they were, you know, their kind of country life, as opposed to the sort of busyness of working with children and teaching and analysis and so on, that sort of out of Vienna in this very almost stereotypically rural setting.
Secluded, you're making it sound a bit secluded?
It's quite secluded, with beautiful views and so with animals in the garden and you know, how you imagine a country house to be.
May I add something? I think
yes.
both for Sigmund Freud and his whole family, but I think quite generally for the German culture, link to nature is very important. And in Freud's letters to Anna, it's very clear how reconnecting with nature is good for the soul in a way. And so having a country house was not uncommon, as you said, but particularly important for Freud's family. That's interesting.
I think so. The two lives influence together, so living in the city and living in the countryside took influence on her and on the way of living. So when I hear that she had her house here in Wolfswick and she liked to go there every Friday at 20:50, so it's a very important thing for her to have this place, and it's part of her life. I found it very interesting when Alice Eichhorn's grandchildren, Thomas Eichhorn, who met Anna Freud in the 70s, told me that when Anna Freud came back to Vienna in the 70s, she really liked to go to Hofburg there. Then she liked to collect flowers, and she really did little hiking tours with Dorothy together. And he said that for him, that might be the most important place for her when she came back to the end of the 70s, being very important there. She seemed to be very happy at that moment. I think it's a very important place, has been a very important place for her, for both of them.
Is your visual exhibition still on?
It's still there 2 weeks.
Two more weeks.
Yeah.
And then it will move.
It will move to New York.
Oh, wow.
But just one substitute, one chest. And we developed 5 little objects which will be part of the exhibit. So one chest will move to the Austrian culture, one to New York. And we try to tell the story with one.
I was struck by the 50 minutes thing as well, that it's still referred to as an hour, but it just isn't an hour.
Yeah.
It's very analytical.
Yeah. In Germany, there's an academic hour. They often talk about the Akademische Viertelstunde.
Well, maybe, Anne-Marie, could you tell us a little bit more about the 50 minutes and who invented the 50 minutes? Or who first had the idea of the... Was it Freud? Was it Sigmund Freud?
I think what I thing to remember, but you will help me, that at the beginning, Freud saw patient for an hour. Is that right?
I'm not entirely
sure. I think for a relatively short time. And then, because when he got many patients, it was difficult to fit everybody, and he had the idea of 50 minutes and he has 10 minutes to take something and go to the toilet put for the next person. That's how I understand the 50 minutes.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Mass production line.
How long is the academic hour?
Was it also 50? They talk about an academic Stunde, which means that the lecture starts at 8 o'clock but actually finishes later. It begins.
After 45 minutes. The lecture.
Maybe our event hour is over. Maybe our event hour is our social
cultural
hour, our fascinating hour is over. Unless anyone has any other burning questions, but I would like to thank all of you. I think we could have actually heard more from each of you. It's been a really, I think you've complimented each other beautifully, and I'm just like, if you can just sort of show your appreciation.